The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I think it's going to be in the context of an opinion that is a shot across the bow to all the other state Supreme Courts saying, we're watching all of you and don't go rogue. And we're worried about some of you going rogue. And so an affirmance would be to say, you haven't gone rogue in this case. But I think, I just don't think they want to duck the issue of not announcing something like at least the Bush versus Gore standard as the shot across the bow. And so then the question becomes, if they are really going to adopt this standard and operationalize it, are they willing to affirm and say, we've announced the standard, but we're actually going to pass on the application of the standard in this case and give the North Carolina Supreme Court a passing grade?
I'm Scott R. Anderson, and this is the Lawfare Podcast for December 8th, 2022. Yesterday morning, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in what may be the biggest case of the term, Moore v. Harper. In that case, North Carolina's state legislature is arguing that the state Supreme Court lacks the legal authority to review the heavily gerrymandered congressional districts it has enacted, on the grounds that the Constitution's Elections Clause gives that authority exclusively to the state legislatures. An argument often referred to as the independent state legislature doctrine, which many fear may undermine state law election protections around the country if taken up by the court. To discuss, I sat down yesterday afternoon with two leading election law experts for a live recording of the podcast on Twitter Spaces, Professor Ned Foley of The Ohio State University Moritz College of Law and Professor Derek Mueller of the University of Iowa College of Law. We discussed where the justices seem to be leaning, how they may resolve different aspects of the party's arguments, and what it all might mean for 2024. It's the Lawfare Podcast for December 8th, dissecting the oral arguments in Moore v. Harper. So Derek and Ned, let's start our conversation at kind of the highest level here. Obviously, oral arguments with the Supreme Court is a little bit like reading tea leaves. You're trying to get a sense of how different justices think about certain issues, different ways they may break down in approaching the case. And that's always a little bit of a risky endeavor, but I'm going to ask you all to peer into the tea glass with me. And Derek, I'll start with you, and then I'll go to Ned. What do you make, just at a high level, of the oral argument today? What hints did you think we got, if any, of where different members of the court may be leaning and how the different ways you might be able to break down the issues in this court that are up for decision in front of them?
Sure. It was a 3-hour argument, and I don't know that there was too much that was surprising from the argument. Let me start with that. It seemed like there were a lot of positions that had already kind of been staked out in some of the cases before, but I will say the first thing that struck me was that the petitioners came in, you know, legislature with a pretty, one might describe as sort of a maximalist position, essentially saying, the state constitution can never substantively constrain the state legislature. You know, Justice Gorsuch was the only one during oral argument who seemed expressly sympathetic to that view. And so it was only pretty late in the day that they sort of reached a fallback position of, well, you know, maybe we should think about this as a fallback about those positions that are those provisions of state constitutions that are explicit or clear. And even that didn't necessarily garner a lot of traction on the court. Instead, I think there were, to the extent that people were interested in suggesting that the Elections Clause has this constraint on what state courts or state constitutions might do, it seemed to draw a lot on Chief Justice Rehnquist's concurring opinion in Bush versus Gore, Which received a lot of attention during this oral argument. And while it's a different context, and there's some wonky reasons to talk about the different context or the fact that this is a constitution as opposed to the statutory issues in Bush versus Gore, it was similar to some of the things raised by the Conference of Chief Justices' amicus brief, which also suggested that maybe there are these outer bounds, what had been described by Neil Cotchall at oral argument for the respondents as sky-high sort of standard, to say that in the most egregious circumstances, there could be a place for the federal courts, or really the United States Supreme Court, to step in and say that a state court just went too far in interpreting its constitution in a fairly bizarre way. So if the North Carolina legislature wins, it might only win on a pretty technical, narrow ground that might not apply to this case. And it might be very difficult for anyone to meet in the future. I don't know. But that was sort of my large level takeaway from today's argument.
Ned, how about you? What was your sense and your takeaway from today's argument?
Yeah, well, again, thanks for having me for this conversation. And I think I largely agree with Derek. The one way I might phrase it is I think the balance of power on the court is searching for some form of middle ground position. So I suspect that's what we'll see at the end. But I think I heard expressed at argument and also in the briefs two distinct different middle ground positions. And it's unclear to me which of those two, might prevail in terms of getting five votes and, enough votes to win. There was one line that the chief had at oral argument. Can't remember who he was asking. Maybe it was Don Verrilli. Was like, if you fall back to your fallback, are you going to hit the other side when they fall back to their fallback? And I think that was some indication that, each side had a kind of fallback position, but they weren't necessarily the same fallback. So if you want, I'd be happy to try to describe what I think is the distinction between the two different middle ground positions, because I think that's where the fight will be ultimately in the end. I don't think the maximalist position will prevail, as Derek suggested. And I think, something like the Bush versus Gore concurrence, which is one of the two middle ground positions, I think is definitely on the table.
So I do want to get into those middle ground positions, because I agree those were where we actually saw most of the action happening, not really on, frankly, the main argument the petitioners spend their time on in their brief and spent their time on in oral argument, at least for those portions in which they were driving the bus. But I want to start with their lead argument first, just to clear the air, because in a lot of ways, it is the argument that has gotten the most attention from the press. I think it's the one that raises the most alarm bells for people, in that it is this maximalist position that state legislatures have the authority to regulate state rules regarding the conduct of federal elections in a way that cannot be subject to judicial review. And in making this case, the petitioners made what is actually kind of an important concession, I think, potentially, if the court were looking for kind of an easy way out without really getting to the merits of certain issues, where they basically say, we're willing to concede that the state court in this case actually correctly interpreted state law, state constitutional law, state statutes. That's fine. But that we just don't think they have the authority to engage in any sort of review like this. How did we see different justices reacting to this? Derek, you already mentioned Justice Gorsuch was the only one who seemed really to nod to it in a way that was even really seemed open to it, at least by my listening, although I welcome correction or alternative views on that. What was the different way the justices approached this issue, which really was the thrust of North Carolina's arguments kind of going into this, North Carolina legislature's, I should say, arguments going into this case?
Yeah, like I said, a lot of skepticism. So Justice Gorsuch, really kind of leaned in to point out that when you talk about sort of the breadth of the petitioner's claim, it's not unchecked, although it certainly removes a check or maybe multiple checks in the process. The point is, there's federal law that governs, federal constitutional law that governs, state courts still have the power to interpret federal law, Congress can always step in, you have political checks. Now, as many have pointed out, they deem those checks ineffectual, but that was sort of the point he was raising. But you saw many other justices Kagan, Jackson, and Sotomayor, for instance, pretty vociferously pointing out the absurdity about their position or the claims that this would undermine the the constitutional provisions in all 50 states, or that there were all these other court cases that they have to deal with. You know, and Justice Kagan really leaning into language from the Supreme Court's recent decisions in the Arizona redistricting case in 2015, Rucho versus Common Cause, the partisan gerrymandering case in 2019. And as much as, you know, the petitioners try to distinguish those things, it was just sort of a, I mean, whether it's a constant barrage of interruptions or statements to say, listen, we've got all these things on the side suggesting that really your position goes too far. And one of the earliest, maybe skeptical pieces came from Justice Barrett, where she was asking about what the petitioner suggested was this substantive procedural divide. That is, the legislature said, well, the procedural devices, the referendum, the veto power, whatever it is, those things are acceptable and they're consistent with the court's precedent. But substantive constraints on the legislature, you know, cannot be binding. And Justice, you know, Barrett kind of put a fine point on it to say, well, is that a distinction that you can hold in the text of the Constitution, or is that a distinction you're drawing for convenience, essentially, because our precedents have already put places where the legislature can be constrained, at least in some procedural places. So I think that was a difficult place. The court, you know, struggled at various points in time. Can we distinguish procedural and substantive? Or the motives of the governor when vetoing a bill, he may be doing so through the process, but with a very substantive judgment. So again, from that maximalist position, and I would venture to say it was a lot of the media commentary, whether you describe it as sky is falling or real worries about the extreme position, there was essentially no appetite, again, setting aside Justice Gorsuch, and you never know privately what might happen in conference, for a majority that would get to that view at the end of the day.
I can jump in and just add, I agree with Derek's analysis of that. I think, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if Gorsuch picked up an extra vote or two on the maximalist position, but I just don't see how he can get, you know, to control the outcome of the case with it. So I think the real fighting will be over, again, you know, what else the court wants to say. And if I can just say one thing about if I'm right about that, or if we're both right about that, you know, one hugely significant consequence is that there will be a lot of state constitutional provisions that will be substantive and will effectually constrain state legislatures. So one of the hypotheticals that came up was, what if a state constitution put in a specific standard for constraining gerrymandering, you know, whether it's the efficiency gap standard or something else, but if it was really written into the state constitution in a clear-cut way, you know, the rejection of the maximalist position means that's judicially enforceable by state supreme courts, and that would, you know, leave a huge chunk of the playing field as it exists in the status quo and make this doctrine much less revolutionary than some people think it has the potential to be.
Well, let's go to those fallback positions now, that we have this idea that this primary argument doesn't look like it had a lot of bites coming from the justices. But the petitioners did pivot fairly quickly under some pressure from a couple of the justices to a secondary argument they had, which is, I take to be kind of a rebuttal of this idea we've seen floated both in briefing and kind of an outside commentary about the case, about the fact that whatever the constitutional structure might be, in this case, it seemed like the state legislature at least arguably authorized a degree of review here by state statutes, right? So that we wouldn't necessarily have to reach this conflict about a court engaging in review in a way contrary to the state legislature. And they made this argument saying, well, you know, even if state legislatures did that, if there are laws that are on the books, in this case, there is an obstacle in that they haven't provided an intelligible principle. They haven't given a sort of line of substantive requirement to whoever they're delegating this rulemaking, election rulemaking authority to, in this case, the courts, that satisfies the requirements of kind of the non-delegation doctrine, all this kind of weird application of that, but non-delegation principles. Instead, they are just providing, you know, wholesale delegating this authority, and that's impermissible. First off, I guess, did we see any other bites in that particular argument or version of the argument from the justices? There was definitely interest in it and prodding it, although I wasn't sure how many actually bought into it. And I guess second, how plausible a way, you know, out of this sort of conundrum might this path be in the first place, in terms of the actual statutes underlying the this kind of claim that they may have been authorized. And were court did the justice seem open to kind of reading the statutes that way in the first place? Ned, let me start with you on this one.
Sure. Well, I think the chief at least expressed interest in what I understand to be the real import of the fallback position, which I think is goes beyond just the details of North Carolina having had a piece of legislation that authorized judicial review under the state constitution. As I understand, you know, the potential significance of the petitioner's fallback, you know, for all around the country, it would essentially be, you know, if people are familiar with the Rucho case, where the U.S. Supreme Court said that a general constitutional provision like just equal protection doesn't supply a judicially manageable standard for policing partisan gerrymandering because, you know, it's too generic. And at least in that context, there's nothing for the judiciary to hang its hat on. And while that in Rucho, that was just an understanding of, you know, the power of the U.S. Supreme Court under the federal constitution, the petitioner's fallback would essentially require state constitutions and state Supreme Courts to to be straitjacketed in the same way, even if they wouldn't like to be. In other words, even if a state Supreme Court said, we like the Rucho dissent that Justice Kagan was, we think we can interpret our state constitution, a free and fair elections clause, an equal protection clause, what have you, to just fine, this position would take that off the table. The U.S. Supreme Court would be making the decision on what's permissibly judicial or not. And there was a bunch of discussion, you know, at several points in the argument about, you know, when a court acts more like a legislature than a court, so that it's not engaging in appropriate judicial behavior and acts in a policymaking legislative role. That's the kind of thing that is a no-no under this fallback theory of the elections clause. That would be still a pretty powerful fallback position. It's not the fully maximalist position, but it would basically mean, you know, generic constitutional standards like due process, equal protection, free and fair, what have you, are off limits to a state Supreme Court unless they're converted into something very specific like one person, one vote. But unless the federal court can't see that specificity, it doesn't count as sufficiently judicial. And I think that is a different middle ground, if you want to call it that, than reliance on the Bush versus Gore theory, which was, I think, a much more modest middle ground.
Maybe I'll take this to sort of bridge to maybe the narrower position, you know, beyond that, because I think Ned's right. I think the court did seem a little nervous about trying to draw that kind of a line, wondering what was going to be sufficiently definite. Again, several briefs articulated this and said there are such things as clear statement rules, and we can identify those. But that's a lot of new policing from the Supreme Court to figure out what the contours of that look like. And the reason I think that an even more modest or narrower position seemed to have a lot more attention on the court in a couple different ways is I think because Chief Justice Rehnquist's opinion in Bush versus Gore really attracted a lot of attention. And I think in an unexpected way, and I'll set it up like this. I think a lot of people looked at, say, Justice Kavanaugh's involvement in the case, right, and his citations to it, or the citations to Palm Beach, and, you know, the things that were happening in 2000. I think people have seen that as, oh, this is sort of an openness to the court's previous forays into the area to suggest, aha, there's limitations on what state courts can do. And very quickly, the petitioners were citing to Palm Beach and to Bush versus Gore, and Justice Kavanaugh asked many specific questions about those cases. But Justice Kavanaugh then also suggested that they were reading it too broadly and saying, well, really, this is standing for a different proposition. Palm Beach was a case in 2000 where the court just said, we're sending this back for the Florida Supreme Court to figure out what's going on. And maybe it doesn't really stand for much doctrine at all. And Chief Justice Rehnquist's opinion really stands for the proposition that there are these true exceptional outliers that we need to step in and exercise some judgment and ensure that we're restraining the state legislature. So while some of these cases and a lot of the language talking about where these ideas come from Bush versus Gore have been in the background for many years, Justice Kavanaugh in particular was sort of crystallizing the notion that, no, Well, Bush versus Gore is this principle. It stands for something much narrower than the kinds of things that you're advocating for here today. And so to the extent that Bush versus Gore is helpful to you, it's actually going to constrain and narrow the kinds of cases, including your own probably, where this doctrine would be applicable. And so in that way, I think the court, a majority of the court, seemed more inclined toward a fairly narrow position with this sort of escape hatch in a subset of circumstances.
Well, I think that leads pretty well into what I took to be the other falling back position, this time by the respondents, all three of whom, of the three different attorneys we saw argue for them, two for the respondents, I should say, one for the United States, the Solicitor General, were kind of put in the position of acknowledging a concession of sorts, if you want to frame it that way, that they made, which is this idea that there are at least some cases, some sort of residual ability of the federal Supreme Court to review how the state Supreme Court interprets the state constitution in application to this sort of issue, some sort of residual federal interest in that. And then there was a lot of debate over the standard that applies there, and actually a bit of disagreement between Neil Katyal, representing one group of respondents, basically saying a super high standard, higher for state constitution than for statutes, very, very high, you know, atmospherically high is where all this discussion of outer space kind of came into the argument. Then you had former Solicitor General Verrilli arguing for another set of respondents, basically saying, I think he actually tried to articulate a standard where he said essentially, the Supreme Court should ask whether a state decision is such a sharp departure from ordinary modes of state constitutional interpretation that it lacks any fair and substantial basis in state law. Basically, a high standard that's also deferential to the interpretive methodology of the state courts, I take it. And then the U.S. government kind of endorsed a version of that view, but framed it more in terms of taking on a policymaking role as opposed to a judicial role. Is that the way that the court and justice seem to be pulling the different threads and the two parties' positions kind of together, falling them together? And do you think those meet in the middle, the kind of secondary fallback or the narrower Bush v. Gore argument and this argument? And if so, how does the Supreme Court seem inclined to deal with this question of a standard, if at all, if it actually has to reach that issue? Ned, I'll start with you.
Yeah. I mean, I think there'll be some effort. I think you set it up nicely, because even though Justice Kagan was resisting the concession that Don Verrilli and others made, I think what we're going to see in the end is at least a version of that. So, you know, I think the starting premise is, and this is kind of significant, I think, you know, this case is going to convert the Bush versus Gore concurrence into some form of majority principle, namely that there is federal judicial review over egregious interpretation of state law by state Supreme Courts in the election space. And that will lead to more litigation, maybe not tons. Again, if it is a very difficult standard or deferential, as Don Verrilli said, maybe not a ton of destabilization, but that's a significant development. But how that cashes out in operation, I think, is really important and goes to your question about whether or not the really fallback is the same as the petitioner's fallback. And Justice Alito, I think, asked a series of questions that really pointed to that. In other words, there was a colloquy, I think, by Justice Alito and Don Verrilli on whether or not the state Supreme Court's decision in this case, the North Carolina Supreme Court, was sufficiently judicial and appropriate under Verrilli's own standard. And of course, he said the answer was yes, but Justice Alito was extremely skeptical of that. And so I think Alito is going to lead a push of the justices on the conservative side that even if the Bush versus Gore concurrence becomes the operative principle in this area, that it's a more robust and vigorous one. It's not nearly as deferential as either Neil Katyal or Don Verrilli or the Solicitor General would have wanted. And I frankly think the Alito position is probably closer to the petitioner's fallback, namely, and I wouldn't be surprised if Justice Barrett and Justice Alito, you know, tried to articulate, just because of their own understanding of what it means to be a good judge is so much more rule-based and more, you know, small c conservative in terms of judicial craft and methodology, I wouldn't be surprised if they imported that kind of perspective and mindset into what they think is permissible for a state court to do. So for a state court to take a clause like a free and fair elections clause and utilize that to police, you know, gerrymandering in a very aggressive way, I certainly could imagine some of the more conservative justices say that's just not sufficiently judicial for us, and we don't really care whether you take that out of Bush versus Gore or you take that out of some other doctrinal analysis, but we just can't let courts do that. I mean, Justice Alito had a series of hypotheticals where he's going down the line. He says, what if there isn't actually a free and fair elections clause, but the state Supreme Court simply says, you know, the fundamental principle of our state constitution is fairness, and therefore we're going to kind of by inference construct a fairness constraint on state legislatures that is judicially enforceable, no textual basis for it, and yet we're going to call that judicial interpretation. It sounded like he wanted to rule that as off limits, and does somebody who is textualist by orientation like a Justice Barrett find that attractive? So it may be that some version of the Bush versus Gore concurrence becomes the operative standard, but it may be, again, something more aggressive than at least what the Verrilli articulation of it was.
And let me jump in, because I think Justice Alito's position, I think, reflected some frustration that the petitioners didn't adopt something like he was suggesting, because he hinted at this. Remember, this case came up as an emergency order back, you know, earlier this year, February, March, and he wrote an opinion dissenting because the court didn't issue a stay. And in his opinion, joined by Justices Gorsuch and Thomas, he pointed out things like there must be some limit to what state legislatures can do, and pointing out that this wasn't just a free and fair elections clause. The North Carolina Supreme Court was construing four different provisions of the Constitution that kind of cast this shadow, if you will, to create an anti-gerrymandering provision. He was very skeptical. At oral argument today, he started reading from the opinion, sort of picking this out as an outlier. And so I think Ned's right to say there's a position that Kochel and Verrilli and Prelogar were suggesting to adopt a version of the Rehnquist concurring opinion in Bush versus Gore, where North Carolina loses, even though that's the standard, North Carolina loses. And then there's a more robust version that adopts something like that standard in Bush versus Gore, but that applies it in this case to say, well, when we're talking about you're not doing what you're doing typically, this isn't the case. Justice Alito asked, is there a series of cases that led up to this decision? Like, could we have seen this one coming down the tracks? Or is this a significant aberration from the way the courts have done? And that's some consistent language that we've seen in other federal courts cases addressing this. And Don Verrilli comes back multiple times to say, the petitioners have conceded that this is ordinary lawmaking because they want to make that more robust position. They want to rest on the substantive thing, not on the outlier rogue state Supreme Court. So Justice Alito might be fighting, you know, the record and fighting the stipulations in this case, if that's the direction he chooses to go. And it's not clear he'll get five votes for it, but it does reflect some of that tension that Ned's highlighted about his position, which again, I think is still narrower than what the petitioners wanted. His position and the position in the Rehnquist concurrence, at least, is floated by many of the respondents' attorneys.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
But that's actually a great segue and an interesting point that I thought came at the close to the end of the oral arguments when Justice Kagan was engaging with Solicitor General Prelogar and really asked, is there a situation, is there a reason we need to reach and resolve this difficult question that you, the respondents, even are disagreeing with a little bit in terms of the applicable standard? And the Solicitor General said no, primarily because the petitioners have already conceded that, in their view, the Supreme Court of North Carolina interpreted the state constitution and state statute correct. They're focusing on the invalidity, constitutional invalidity of that action. But if you say they're wrong on that front, they don't really contest the actual accuracy of interpretation of state law. And therefore, you don't need to reach this question because the issue actually isn't squarely before you. Do you all see it as likely that the Supreme Court would tread down that line and use that as a route to get away from having to address these difficult issues? Or does it seem like enough justices are intent on crafting some sort of standard in this Bush v. Gore space slash this kind of related concession space by the respondents that we're going to get a debate about it? And then where do you look to establish that standard, particularly because it's an issue that was briefed in various regards, but not squarely briefed, not at length. So what do they seem likely to look to in crafting that? Ned, how about you?
You know, we've talked about the petitioner's concession, which I think is fair to call it that, you know, on their theory, you take the state Supreme Court decision as a valid interpretation of state law and really, really hammered that, as we've been saying. On the other hand, in the rebuttal time, I think the very first thing, you know, petitioner's counsel said on rebuttal was, oh, no, don't interpret our concession that way. He said that concession was for the limited purposes of analyzing our own theories, our primary maximalist theory and our own fallback theory. But if you're not going to adopt either of our theory, then we do think the North Carolina Supreme Court's decision flunks Bush versus Gore. So, you know, whether that was enough of a retraction of their own concession, but I think that was significant for this reason. I mean, you know, when the nine justices sit at conference, you know, what they do is they announce their vote and then they explain their reasonings for their vote. And so that they will need to decide, are they affirming the North Carolina Supreme Court or are they reversing? And you know, obviously this case is going to have huge implications beyond this one state and this one issue of gerrymandering, but I think some of the justices will have to decide, do they want to be on record as affirming or reversal? What the respondents all want is an affirmance. And when the Solicitor General says, oh, no, you don't need to touch the Bush versus Gore standard. Yes, I think they would like that. But that seems to me an unlikely outcome. I think if there is something that affirms the North Carolina Supreme Court, I think it's going to be in the context of an opinion that is a shot across the bow to all the other state Supreme Courts saying, we're watching all of you and don't go rogue. And we're worried about some of you going rogue. And so an affirmance would be to say, you haven't gone rogue in this case. But I think, I just don't think they want to duck the issue of not announcing something like at least the Bush versus Gore standard as the shot across the bow. And so then the question becomes, if they are really going to adopt this standard and operationalize it, are they willing to affirm and say, we've announced the standard, but we're actually going to pass on the application of the standard in this case and give the North Carolina Supreme Court a passing grade? It's clear Justice Alito doesn't want to give it a passing grade, and I just don't know that I can tell exactly where the votes end up on that.
So another big factor that enters into this decision and that the kind of two sides of the issue have very, very different approaches to is this question of historical practice. And we really see the petitioner, saw the petitioner in oral argument as in briefing, really lean really hard on both an originalist perspective and particularly on Bruin, the Second Amendment case that this court decided last term that kind of embraced a fairly aggressive originalist methodology of sorts, and particularly focusing on kind of the pre-1820 period as kind of the decisive period for an originalist understanding of parts of the Constitution. Very convenient for the petitioners here, but because, of course, there's a lot of fairly, arguably at least, inconsistent state practice after 1820 up until the present day. Some dispute over, you know, the details of that state practice, but I think most agree there's a lot of problematic state practice, certainly for the petitioners, both during that founding period, but particularly afterwards. How do we think this originalist angle is going to fit into this case, and particularly this effort that some justices seem inclined to pursue of crafting out a more middle ground? Of course, you know, Justice Gorsuch, Justice Thomas seem more, maybe more friendly to petitioners, and they're some of the strongest originalist viewpoints, but Justice Barrett has a very strong originalist viewpoint and had some methodological kind of questions coming out of Bruin, at least hinted at. How does the kind of new emerging originalist framework and methodological questions, how might that enter into this case? Or are we likely to see this them kind of get pushed beneath the surface in pursuit of a kind of cleaner resolution? Ned, let me start with you on that.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating question. My instinct is it's not going to end up quite the major statement like in Bruin for this reasons. I don't see Justice Kavanaugh and the Chief fully on board with the originalist project in this context. I thought, you know, it was quite telling that the Chief Justice said, you know, the nature of judicial practice was so different at the time of the founding than it is today. It seems hard to constitutionalize today a new standard based on the nature of the way courts worked, you know, over 200 years ago. And so while, you know, the Second Amendment may have lent itself to originalism, you know, for other reasons, and that both Kavanaugh and Roberts were willing to go along with, I could be completely wrong, but my instinct is I think they are more going to be concerned about the institutional relationship of federal courts to state courts has evolved over time. I mean, the discussion of the independent and adequate state doctrine, which is not a proposition of election law, but is a proposition of federal court practice in terms of the U.S. Supreme Court having appellate jurisdiction over federal issues coming out of the state system. To me, that's a clue that at least, you know, for more moderate conservatives like Roberts and Kavanaugh, I think they'd like to find the doctrinal solution to this problem in that more familiar space. And so while I think maybe Justice Barrett and Justice Gorsuch will be eager to apply the new originalist methodology to this problem, and you'll see an opinion, you know, coming from them, I predict more that that's a concurrence rather than the majority opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'll just add it's this is a messy case for whether you describe it as whatever you put as originalism. You've got a lot of precedents that you have to grapple with, some of them much older. And you saw some of that coming out of oral argument. The gubernatorial veto, for instance, the argument being that the veto is really a exercise of legislative power held by the executive, or that there are some ways in which we can conceive of the executive as being part of the legislature for purposes of this provision of the Constitution. So you see some of that. It's not clear how much weight that's going to carry. And then you've got to deal with, well, there were these laws on the books at the founding. There were constitutional provisions that may or may not have regulated federal elections, and there's fights about that. There are questions about when did state courts first start to try to enforce those provisions of state constitutions? Because that's a relatively recent phenomenon in terms of state courts exercising equitable jurisdiction. So there's a host of really messy and complicated issues to sift through. And I think it's a reason why Justice Barrett early on was suggesting, you know, some of the distinctions even the petitioners are drawing, substantive versus procedural or whatever they are not really baked into the text of the Constitution, but you have to infer from some sort of structural separation of powers, early practices issues, and so on. And that's just a much trickier project, especially when you've got all this gloss of existing precedents lurking around out there in the background. So I sense it's less going to be like a Bruin decision, as Ned said, and more a decision that draws upon, again, adequate and independent ground is a sort of well-established doctrine of federal courts, a gloss placed upon how the federal courts review these decisions from the state courts, imperfect in its own right, but a ready-made principle that you can pull up and give you a standard for reviewing and checking what state courts are doing. So I think that's a reason why it's attractive, and the reason why it was attractive for Chief Justice Rehnquist in Bush versus Gore. But you know, it's a wait and see about the methodological approach.
So the other big factor that we saw hit particularly hard by the respondents for very understandable reasons is the kind of practical consequences of a decision. What Neil Katyal kind of memorably characterized as the blast radius of the opinion, right? The scope of existing state laws and practices and recent and past elections whose legitimacy and credibility and legality will be undermined if you were to pursue the petitioner's maximalist view, certainly. And then even with more narrower views, you have, in theory, I guess, a blast radius, and then perhaps maybe what also should be characterized as a blast zone, an area where it's not clear whether something is valid or not, but litigation becomes much more likely, doubts become much more likely, it raises a lot of bigger questions. What is your all sense about where we seem to be headed in terms of that blast radius and that blast zone, to borrow, use my own metaphor, although feel free to abandon it because I'm not sure how good it is. Do we have a sense of what the court's tolerance for risk is in adopting a particular perspective? Do they seem more resistant to that? And does that give us do they take approaches to one or the other? Are they more willing to perhaps open the floodgates to litigation but far less willing to maybe invalidate anything on its face or make anything clearly seem validated, barring a more specific, fact or context specific analysis for whatever that other issue is? Derek, I'll start with you.
I mean, it's really hard. I mean, I think there's no question that the court dislikes having these cases, doesn't want to have to wade in all the time. We saw a lot of them come up and the court, has to issue no decision or issue a stay and receive criticism for it, or some of the justices will dissent from the stay. And we saw this time and time again, the 2020 election. And you can sense in some places trying to articulate a rule and asking quite explicitly of the parties, what rule am I supposed to be writing here? I mean, not uncommon in arguments, but I think notable here is where they're thinking about the litigation risk. And thinking about the risk that if these cases are coming out of state courts, the next stop is the United States Supreme Court. Most of these are not going to be filed in the federal district courts. So if there's going to be error correction, it's happening at the United States Supreme Court. So I think that came across explicitly and implicitly throughout the argument, and I think they're aware of it. And again, a reason why when Justice Alito is pointing out this concern about a standard that is almost impossible to flunk for the state Supreme Court, does it invite sort of this litigation? Does it invite hope? As some people have said, does it invite a pretext? A lot of shoddy legal arguments were floated around in contests around the 2020 election, sort of bandied about as snake oil to state legislatures. Does this give you a hook to be able to show up and say, aha, this is the basis for doing so? I'm not sure. So I think there's some skepticism from the court about whatever standard it has, that it wants something that's going to be administrable and avoid the litigation. And in some ways that might be more persuasive to them than saying, oh, dozens of election laws might be in peril. That might be okay for some members of the court. They'll say there's other checks in the process. Congress can step in, all that. There can be two tracks of election administration. That's not our concern. I think many of them are much more concerned about the practical judicial administration costs. And we'll see what they come up with as a result.
Yeah, I guess I would add, I think some of the justices see risks in both directions. I mean, I definitely think they would recognize an adverse cost of just, having all these new cert petitions to deal with involving this new doctrine. On the other hand, I think we know that several of the justices, going back to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court's decision extending the deadline for submitting absentee ballots in 2020, was from their perspective, whether you agree or disagree, but from their perspective, the poster child of what they don't want to see state Supreme Courts doing. And again, Justice Alito, I think, articulated that a little bit without reference to that particular case, I don't think, at oral argument. But the idea, that elected state Supreme Courts can be very partisan in their dealing with election cases. And I think the majority of the Supreme Court does not want to rule in this case in a way that divests themselves of a final authority of having a checking function. So I think they're willing to entertain a certain amount of increased litigation risk in order to give themselves what they see as an appropriate role. And I think they trust themselves. Other people may view them as partisan, but they don't view themselves that way. And so I think they're going to hold on to that power, for themselves. And then the other reason why I think some of the justices might be attracted to the petitioner's fallback provision is, I think, again, it might invite a certain amount of contestation, but if the consequence of the petitioner's fallback is basically to force state constitutional law to have greater specificity so as to constrain state Supreme Courts from having more interpretive running room. It's, again, right or wrong, I think some of the U.S. Supreme Court justices say, well, that's just fine by us. We're happy to have a world in which state constitutions can police federal elections, but we just want to create a regime that requires those state constitutions to do that with sufficient specificity that we can double check and make sure that the courts are being genuinely judicial from our perspective. And so we're going to announce a standard that brings about that world. And it may be a little bit destabilizing in the interim, but it will lead to a better world because there'll be more clarity about what constitutions can and can't do. They've got to be specific. And so state Supreme Courts won't have the ability to be so creative, but they may not think that's a bad thing.
So I want to leave a little bit of time. We've gotten one or two listener questions, although I think we've already kind of covered one. But one last point to kind of end with you all from me before I turn to those is obviously a background consideration, a reason why this case has gotten so much attention and so much has been such a source of concern is its relevance not just to congressional elections, but what some see as potential relevance to presidential elections down the road because of the similar language regarding state legislatures that's in the Elections Clause relating to federal congressional elections. That's at issue here. That's the basis for the petitioner's argument here. There's similar language in the Electors Clause regarding the selection of electors who ultimately select the president. And arguments rooted in a similar logic have been, were invoked in 2020. Only one or two amicus even really hinted at them that I saw. You know, even the petitioners here kind of said this issue isn't really relevant. But I feel like we need to address it before we step away. Does it seem like we're going to get anything out of this opinion that's likely to bear on potential arguments under a version of the independent state legislature doctrine that bear on that electors clause context that's relevant to presidential elections, particularly if we don't get the petitioner's broadest vision of how this language should be read? Granted, do these more moderate positions have relevance there that's worth bearing in mind? Derek, I'll start with you.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, these cases were litigated in 2020. The absentee ballot case in Pennsylvania, for instance, among others, as electors clause cases, as legislature thereof component of the electors clause as opposed to the elections clause. So I anticipate that whatever comes out of this, especially if they're borrowing from Bush versus Gore, which is an electors clause case, it will have some relevance there. The big difference between the two clauses, of course, being that Congress does not have express authorization to override the state laws in the Electors Clause context. So the stakes in some ways are higher there because there are fewer checks in the process on the state legislature. But my sense is the court tends to read these clauses together. Not always, but will tend to read these clauses together. The standard it draws, to the extent it has a very narrow vision, some sort of Chief Justice Rehnquist vision of the Bush versus Gore case will apply. And again, there is the risk, right, of continuing that litigation incentive by describing that, oh, this is another way in which the state courts can be reviewed by the United States Supreme Court, raising all the very same sorts of risk and trade-off concerns we talked about earlier.
Yeah, I agree with Derek. I think, as he said, Bush versus Gore was came up in the presidential election context. And so, but I think it's important to distinguish between two aspects of potential relevance here for presidential elections. One is like Bush versus Gore itself or the Pennsylvania litigation in 2020. That's when, the two sides are fighting over the rules that were set up ahead of time and are those rules being enforced through proper judicial interpretation or not. That's the kind of thing that the decision in this case would have bearing on. But the key point there is that's when the relevant state statute was adopted prior to the casting of the ballots in the popular vote on which the electors are appointed. And as opposed to the fear that some people have articulated that I don't think is properly understood to be at risk, is the idea that the legislature in a presidential election could come in after the fact and repudiate the popular vote and say, we're just going to appoint electors directly. I can't see any result in Moore versus Harper that would permit that theory. And I think that theory is non-tenable because, you know, once the date for the election has been set by Congress, state law can only operate up to the point of the appointment on that date. And so there's no legislative authority to undo the appointment that's already occurred pursuant to state law. I think the petitioners in their own reply brief conceded that point. One of their amicis also conceded it. I didn't hear anything about that in oral argument today. So I think any implication in the context of presidential elections will be confined to the same scope that Bush versus Gore itself had and not extend to this, you know, much more dramatic consequence, but which I don't think is really at risk at all.
Let me go to our remaining listener question then, which is just the question I think all law professors are waiting to hear. So hopefully you all are prepared for it. How would you decide this case if you were in the position of the justices?
Well, I wrote an amicus brief saying it should be decided on statutory grounds and that 2 USC 2C embraces the notion that congressional districts are supposed to be drawn by law. By law include state courts interpreting state constitutions. That was raised very late in the argument. Justice Alito seemed somewhat disgusted with the argument in questions with the Solicitor General. So if that were me, that would be how I decide this case. I mean, I think there are so many procedural hurdles to get over, especially as some people have pointed out. You know, the North Carolina Supreme Court has a different makeup right now. The North Carolina legislature is going to get to draw a new map for 2024 on its own. So, you know, for me, taking a narrow statutory ground and saving the more complicated questions for another day, but that's the luxury of a law professor to save them, and rather as opposed to the litigants who have the boots on the ground issues to be wanting the clear guidance for the future.
And I'll say I just thought Derek's position was brilliant, and I think the court would be well advised to take it. I didn't, unfortunately, see much appetite for it. So, you know, putting that aside, I guess I was enamored by the way that Don Verrilli articulated, you know, that narrow version of the fallback. I thought that was a pretty sensible approach. So, you know, that would be something that I would gravitate to, but I don't know that it's going to get 5 votes.
Well, we will have to wait and find out, and maybe we'll have a chance to revisit the conversation then. Until then, however, we are out of time. Derek Mueller, Ned Foley, thank you for joining us here today on the Lawfare Podcast.
Thanks so much for having us.
It's a pleasure.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please be sure to rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. And check out Lawfare's other podcasts, including Rational Security, a casual, lighthearted chat about national security news that I co-host each week with my colleagues Quinta Jurecic and Alan Rosenstein. Also, be sure to visit lawfareblog.com for our extensive written coverage of national security law and policy issues, and consider becoming a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare to gain access to an ad-free version of this and other Lawfare podcasts, among other perks. This podcast was edited by Jen Patcha Howell, and our audio engineer was Kara Schillen of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.